Hello and welcome to episode 421 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Nathan Fox. With me is Ben Olson. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. You can be LSAT famous by sharing news or asking questions on our website. That's thinkinglsat.com. Monday, October 9th at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Mark your calendars for Ben's class. Ben is opening up his class to everyone with a demon-free account. Just go to lsat.link/free. Again, that is Monday, October 9th. It's a one-hour class?
It's a one-and-a-half-hour class, and we'll be doing logical reasoning questions. So you just show up. I'm going to give you time to do a few questions, and then we will go over them together, and you can learn how to approach them. And then we'll do that again and then do that a third time. So hopefully by the end, you can really start to see how to approach LR questions.
A logical reasoning extravaganza with Ben. There will also be, I'm sure, Abigail and probably a couple other LSAT Demon teachers on hand to answer all of your questions. So if you show up, you're going to get not just Ben teaching his class, but you're going to get a few of our other tutors there to talk to you about whatever's on your mind and talk to you about what the LSAT Demon experience is like. Again, that's lsat.link/free if you want to register for that free class. September 2023 scores are going to be coming out around the time that this podcast airs. If you took the September 23 test and you want to let us know how it went, good or bad, we would love to hear about it. Again, that's at our website, thinkinglsat.com. Today on the show, we had an amazing interview with Judge Douglas Nazarian from the Appellate Court of Maryland. Ben, anything you want to say about the interview with the judge?
Oh, it was fascinating. And I was just blown away by how much he had to do to eventually become a judge, or just the time frame, right, that's involved with becoming a judge. But yeah. Otherwise, fascinating.
I'm blown away that we were able to get a judge to come on our podcast. if you think about our roots of where, you know, how we started this thing 10 years ago or whatever it was.
Yeah.
It's all because of our team, right? I mean, we have to thank Matt Dumont, especially for getting the judge to agree to come on the podcast.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to that interview. Our guest today is Judge Douglas R.M. Nazarian. He has served on the Appellate Court of Maryland since January of 2013. He joined the court after 5 years at the Maryland Public Service Commission and 15 years as a litigator in law firms in Washington and Baltimore. He's a graduate of Yale College and Duke Law School, clerked for Judge James B. Locken of the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. He serves as well as a senior adjunct professor at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law. And our connection, Judge, is from Matt Dumont. How did you know Matt? Did he work with you?
Oh, well, Matt was a student of mine last spring. So the class I teach is a workshop that students have to take if they're doing a judicial externship for credit. So the class is it's pass-fail class, but it's about the judiciary. It's about sort of how judges do their jobs in all the different settings, trial court settings, appellate court settings, state and federal, and all that. So the students are all spending most of the semester with one particular judge. Matt was with a Maryland Supreme Court justice who actually sits on the other end of the floor from me. But the students are in the class are all, you know, with different kinds of judges. And so the workshop helps put some context around their particular experience. And they learn some from each other as well and learn about sort of broader issues about access to justice and how decisions get made and stuff like that. I actually met Matt before that, though, when he applied to come clerk for me. And he ended up getting hired by a different Maryland Supreme Court justice, Justice Houghton, out from under me. So, because we're all hiring at the same time. So
competing.
We're all often competing for a lot of the same students. And so he had applied to me, and I interviewed him. Justice Houghton moved faster on him than I did. And so he started his clerkship with her a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. You missed a gem there. he was a student of mine back in Los Angeles, an LSAT student of mine. And then he worked with me in my own business, and he was instrumental in helping Ben and I build LSAT Demon online. And then he became one of our favorite all-time teachers at LSAT Demon. He's
terrific, and he's a fascinating guy too. I mean, you know, he has before law school, a terrific personal story, and you know, was an actor and did all kinds of really interesting things that I imagine will translate pretty well to the courtroom once he gets there, which he'll be with Justice Houghton for this year. He'll finish with her next summer, and then as I recall it, he very much wants to be a public defender or do criminal defense. So he'll be on his feet before you know it.
Yeah, and he'll love it, I'm sure. So I guess we can start with a real broad question. Why and how did you become a judge?
Well, so those are two different questions. So I first got the bug, especially the appellate bug, during moot court in law school. And there was just something about that exercise where you have an issue, a couple of issues that are being teed up for, you know, a group of judges to decide. You have a sort of a record that's been developed in the trial level proceeding. Moot court is all made up, obviously, we had a moot court competition first year at Duke, and I really enjoyed it, and then did that through the rest of law school, and ended up getting a clerkship with a federal appellate judge in he then was in St. Paul, Minnesota, until they built the big Minneapolis courthouse a few years later. And that totally cemented it, right? The year of working directly with the judge and with the court, and getting to see how the decisions got made and getting to help draft the opinions and being part of that. I came out of that year saying, like, I want that guy's job. The problem is you can't just sign up for that, right? There's not like a judge training. In some countries there is, right? It's sort of a civil service job, and you get into it early and kind of work your way through it. In the US, that's not how it works at all. You have to get some governor or some president to select you, for the most part. Some states you can run for it. Maryland, you get appointed to an appellate court by the governor. So you have to spend, probably the bulk of the years of your career sort of getting yourself in a position to make that possible. And then you have to get hit by lightning, right? Like things have to line up in all the different ways they have to line up. The opening has to come at a good time. You have to have a nominating commission and a governor who are going to see you as a good candidate. You can't control who else applies. And so there's just lots of different variables. You control some variables. You control the body of work you've built up. You control the support you can try to gather up in the broader community, in the pitch you make for yourself. But there are lots of things you can't control. So I was fortunate. I'd been in private practice for the first 15 years after my clerkship, but my intention all along was to spend the prime of my career in public service, ideally in exactly this kind of role as an appellate judge. And so in my sort of mid to late 30s, started developing the plan to try to make this happen. And it really involved getting involved in state level politics here in Maryland, and supporting the then mayor of Baltimore, Martin O'Malley, who then ran for governor. And after he became governor, I had an opportunity to go work in a state agency called the Public Service Commission, which regulates electricity companies and natural gas and telephones and private water companies and taxi cabs and the occasional bridge. And so I had the opportunity to go there as the general counsel. And then my boss left, and Governor O'Malley appointed me to chair the commission, which I did that for the next 4.5 years. Hmm. And so when the opening came on the court, I had spent a lot of time working in that administration and had come to know the governor and had, you know, built up a body of not only my private practice work, but also my public service. And so, you know, there were a lot of terrific candidates, including another guy who's a colleague of mine now who got a seat right after mine. But I was fortunate to have the opportunity to get picked. And that was 10 and a half years ago.
Wow. It's really the long game that you were playing that whole time.
It's a total long game. I think it was solidly 6 years from the intentional decision to start doing things to make it happen. I mean, it was a super long game, like back from law school, like, okay, this is something I want to do. But then the actual sort of tangible part spread out over, yeah, about 6 or 7 years.
Makes me want to ask what your long game is now.
No, this is the long game. I mean, this is it. I mean, I applied for an opening on what we now call the Maryland Supreme Court a couple of years ago and was not selected for that one. It's possible that could open up again. Although we have in Maryland, the Constitution retires us at age 70. And so you start butting up against some age barriers. So the seat I'd be eligible for on the Maryland Supreme Court is what the justice who holds it now will age out when I'm about 62. And so, you know, is it possible? It's possible. Is it who knows? Anyway, so there may be an opportunity, but no, like this, the appellate judging gig is it's the end game.
Yeah.
You know, if I had an opportunity to serve on our high court, I'm sure I would be grateful for that. But I'm thrilled where I am now. There are some cool advantages to being on a middle tier court. One of which is they pick their cases, right? The high courts are, you know, what we call certiorari courts, where they only hear the cases they decide to hear. And that is a cool and powerful thing in itself for them. We in our court, you know, anybody who has the right to appeal anything from a trial court in Maryland comes here. So we see literally everything. And I really love that. It's you know, not all cases are super complicated or raise the most glamorous issues, but it's always real people, real businesses, real issues that affect real lives. And so, you know, whatever it is, we get to decide that. And my clerks, we write a higher volume of opinions, but we put the same care and depth into them. So my clerks over the course of the year will write 20 or 25 opinions each, and really across the whole spectrum of what could come before us. And for them, it's a terrific experience, terrific growth opportunity. And I remember getting asked when I applied for the court, and I think even Governor O'Malley asked me this. He said, like, at the time I was running this state agency that was pretty visible, and we'd had a couple of really big merger cases, and we'd had a lot of sort of visible issues. He's like, do you really want to leave this to go decide divorce cases? And I said, well, the thing is, the running the agency, you still have a million day-to-day sort of regular cases too. You have the occasional big merger or something that gets some spotlight. But the real value you're adding is you're deciding things that need to be decided, whatever that context is. And here, you know, we get to do that with the greatest possible breadth. So our court, we literally hear everything: criminal, civil, juveniles, big cases, little cases, you name it. And they're all important. And our court also is, if not unique, it is unusual for state intermediate appellate courts in that we write a full-blown opinion in practically every case. So you're, you know, two neighbors fighting about their fence, they get a 20-page opinion from us that lays it all out like you read in a law school casebook. And I think that serves the public well. I mean, I think people know what we decided and why we decided it, and hopefully that the result is they feel like they were taken seriously, even if they lose. They feel like they got taken seriously and someone put some real effort into trying to unpack and decide the case.
It sounds very beneficial, but why is it that you do write a full opinion for all these cases? Because isn't it the case that, I mean, yeah, some courts don't, right? They just issue an opinion and it's, or the decision, I guess.
Yeah, a lot of them do that. They have, in fact, my senior law clerk, she clerked on a similar court in Florida and wrote barely any opinions. And most of their decisions were issued in these one page summaries, you know. This is a divorce case. The decision of the lower court is affirmed or reversed, and that's all they say. And I mean that kind of opinion, ruling, order, whatever you call it, like, of course it resolves the appellate questions, but it doesn't tell anybody why, right? I mean, and I mean the you know, this smart aleck answer, I suppose, is that's just how our court's always done it, and we've had the volume and the bandwidth among the judges and the teams that we've been able to continue doing it. There are some cases, we do cull out a small number of cases every month that don't get like the full-blown chamber's opinion. They get a summary one, although it's 4 or 5 pages instead of like the full-on one. But that's a, you know, that's 10 or 15 cases a month. Everything else gets the full treatment. And I think it's valuable because, again, the parties, whoever they are, right, it's the case that's important to them. I mean, I think back, my dad got into a couple car accidents a number of years ago. And from the broader, you know, perspective of judges and courts and what was going on, they were very run-of-the-mill auto accident cases. But they were a source of enormous stress and anxiety for him. He was worried, you know, that the other person was claiming to not only have been hurt in this accident, but to have, you know, it had ruined her business and ruined her life. And, you know, the demand was a large sum of money that he didn't have. And of course, you know, if you're a lawyer, you realize that complaints can contain whatever someone wants to put in them, right? You know, on information and belief, I'll allege this. There's, you know, some good faith limit to it, but for the most part, you know, they contain all kinds of garbage that you want to use to try to shoot for the moon or scare the other side or whatever. And I know that, but he didn't know that. And getting those cases resolved was really important to him. And they did get resolved, by the way. I predicted they would both settle for under a number that was pretty small, and they did. But getting to that endpoint was really important, and it mattered. It matters to individual people. If it's your child custody issue, if it's your business that's getting sued, if it's your criminal charges, that matters to you. And especially we try around here to write our opinions for the losing party, not so much the lawyer, although that's part of it. And you have to cover all the legal stuff. But I want the losing party to be able to read our opinion and know what happened to them and why. And again, they're not going to be happy if they lost, but hopefully they feel as though we took their arguments seriously. Here's this real bit of work that went into understanding your case, describing what happened, working through all the issues, and leading to the conclusion. And, you know, as a branch of government, as public servants, I feel like that's a really important way for us to perform this function that, you know, yeah, you know, we can talk about separation of powers issues and branches of government and all that high theory stuff. But ultimately, we have individual people and businesses who have come to this branch of government for a reason and to be served. And I feel like we do a terrific job of doing that.
How are you appointed for a fixed term or?
We get appointed and then we have to stand for what's called a retention election every 10 years. So I went on the ballot in 2014. You go on and it just says, do you vote to retain this judge? Yes or no? So no one can run against you. And then that's good for, so I'll be back on the ballot in 24. No Maryland appellate judge has lost this election. So, I haven't garnered enough negative attention to get 50% plus one of the votes to be no's.
Right.
I had a comfortable margin last time. Hopefully.
Good. Some listeners might be surprised that to get there, you said that you had supported a mayor who then became governor.
Right.
That sounds political.
Well, it is political. The first thing I think I said in that sequence was you have to get some president or some governor to decide to appoint you.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's a political decision in the broadest sense of the term political, right? You have an executive branch officer whose job it is to appoint judges to openings. And so you need that person to make the decision to appoint you. I think it's naive to think that there's no small p politics in that. Does that mean, I don't mean to suggest there's a pay for play or anything untoward about it, but the reality is you have to be in a position where the decision maker knows who you are and has the opportunity to pick you. And so, you can do that lots of ways. And in my instance, I think I had an element of the opportunity to go into public service in the first place came from not only the fact that I had supported this governor, but I also knew and believed in him. It was an administration I wanted to work in. And so it was a situation where my sort of views of government and policy kind of aligned with what he was doing as an executive branch leader and candidate. And then, it aligned with the opportunity to seek this office. We worry a lot, and there's a lot of talk now, of course, about politics in the judiciary and a lot of especially the sort of the most visible courts, state intermediate appellate courts aren't visible in some ways, but I mean, there's a lot of national news about, the Supreme Court of the United States and a lot of other courts and whether the different judges or decisions are politically motivated or not. That's not what I'm talking. That's a big concern, and I'm not poo-pooing that. But you can't ignore the reality that we all get this opportunity based either on a decision by an elected official to appoint us to it, or in other places where you run for election, by going out and running for election, just like everybody else does. So the irony is, we have to be sort of political, again, small p political enough to get ourselves into this role. And then, then we're supposed to not be political. And I'm not, in the sense that I don't make contributions. I don't engage in any partisan political activity. I follow all the important ethical limitations on that, and I believe deeply in those. But at the same time, we're all still the same human beings that came here. So, and maybe that's the real way to think about it is, and we talked about this in class yesterday, actually, you can learn the law in law school, and you do, but ultimately what judges are doing is applying that law to real life and individualized situations. And they're doing it, they're human beings doing it, right? One thing people don't always understand about appellate courts is we are not a do-over. We don't look at the decision that comes from a trial court and say, I agree with that or I disagree with that. That's not what we do. What we do is look at whether the right law got applied, whether the procedure was fair enough, and whether the record supports the decision that the trial court made. And there's a range of out. I mean, if they get the law completely wrong, fine. You tell them they got it wrong and you send it back. But But assuming they're applying the right legal principles in the first place, most cases there's a range of outcomes that different judges, different juries could end up with. And those are going to, if they're supported, they're going to get affirmed by us, even if I would set the number somewhere else. I mean, think about it. You know, you look at a divorce case where there's child support, right? The record might support $1,000 a month in child support or $3,000 in child support. And the judge who sets it at $1,100 is going to get affirmed, just like the judge who sets it at $2,900. The judge who sets it at $3,500, maybe not, right? Like, we're a check on decisions that go sort of outside the range of what's supportable. But there's always going to be a range of decisions that is. And so, you know, our job is to make sure that the human beings who made the decisions we're reviewing made them in a correct manner, not I agree with that and that's how I would have done it. And it recognizes the reality that different people could reach different rational conclusions in the same case. And that's okay. Our system is meant to tolerate that. Now you could say, well, you know, two parties trying the same case before two different judges could get two different results. How is that fair? And the answer is, well, if we knew a way to say there was exactly one right answer, you wouldn't have anything to fight about, right? And maybe you guys are the AI experts. You know, maybe we're going to get to a point where, like, we just train AI, large language models on sort of databases of law and facts, and we'll get to a world where it spits out an answer, and I'll be made obsolete. But that's not how it works. We have human beings exercising discretion and putting individual nuance behind it, and that's how our system is built, and it's an incredibly important aspect of it. So it ties back into sort of the original questions, like, you know, why am I here? Because I wanted to be here. I wanted to be one of the people that had the opportunity to make those kind of decisions, and I was fortunate enough that I was selected to do it. And the voters have kept me here so far, and hopefully will give me 10 more.
Yeah, that's great. I was thinking about as you were talking about this range of possible outcomes, right? This I guess you could say the reasonable range of outcomes that you would accept on the appellate level. And this could be way off, but I get to play judge a little bit in my life because I have kids and they get in, you know, disputes all the time about whoever, you know, is going to play on the Switch or whatnot. And what always strikes me is how obvious it can seem to say, you know, no, we're not going to do this, or yes, we're going to do that, until you start getting the other side of the story. And even then, at some point, you got to stop in terms of how many facts you're going to bring into, you know, how far back in history are we going to consider this dispute? Because sometimes the concerns don't have to do with just what happened right now, but what happened yesterday and what always seems to happen. And this is why I'm so frustrated. And I guess when I think about cases, and I guess this is why evidence law maybe is so robust, is you have to decide, okay, what facts are we actually going to consider here?
Right.
And how much weight are we going to give to each of those facts? And all of that, all those small variables could lead to a lot of different outcomes depending on what totally. You want to consider and how much weight you want to give it.
No, that's exactly right. A former colleague and mentor of mine burst my bubble a long time ago. Someone had around him said the words something like litigation is a search for truth. And he said, that is not true. litigation is a process of trying to win. And actually, if you think about it, you made exactly this point. The rules of evidence actually are the framework for the alternative reality that gets created in each lawsuit, right? So a thing happened, right? If you had omniscient an omniscient narrator who watched the auto accident happen, you'd know exactly what happened. But we don't have that. I mean, maybe sometimes we have video and that helps. But normally what we're doing then is constructing, in the context of a lawsuit, we're constructing the reality that we're going to ask this jury to decide on, right? And you can shape that reality by the decisions that get made about what evidence comes in and what evidence doesn't. And those decisions get shaped in all kinds of ways. Like some are as mundane as, well, we never found the witness who saw whether the light was green or red, so we couldn't find them and call them. Others are, you know, things that lawyers can influence or screw up, right? The case starts off with a scheduling order that says you have to designate your expert witnesses by X date. And if you miss that deadline and you don't get your accident reconstruction expert designated in time, judge could say, no expert for you. And now you're going to trial without an expert. If you had gotten it in time, you'd have this expert, you know, building out the case. It could be a very different presentation. Jury might view it very differently. So there's a combination of the general challenge of trying to reconstruct events that happened in the past with pieces of evidence that you can pull together. Maybe there's a, you know, the store across the street had a surveillance camera, or somebody's the ring cameras, they're everywhere now, right? Maybe the police come after the accident and someone says something on the body cam, so you can hear that. Maybe you can get something out of the car's, data recorder. Maybe you had a witness, maybe you didn't, maybe you had something somebody said to their insurance company right after, but you're like piecing, you know, it's like making a collage instead of having a photograph. And so, you know, that's going to look like whatever it looks like. But you can, you know, right. The trial judge has a lot of discretion in how to manage what bits of magazine come in to make that collage. And you can end up three different judges, three different collages. And, you know, and some of the decisions that, you know, you make along that path can have a huge impact in what the case ends up looking like.
The parties have a lot of discretion too, right? I mean, if you think about the prosecution in a criminal case, they've got 10 different witnesses maybe, but, you know, they've got this one witness that they could bring in and could help us find truth. But if they bring that witness in, then it's going to open up this whole can of worms for the defense, and the prosecution's looking for like a streamlined, simple case to a verdict, right? So they're not going to bring them in at all. And then the defense isn't going to bring them in at all either, because they don't have a burden of proof. So they're just, okay, so now we're like fighting over this limited set of facts.
That's true. And there are rules that constrain that to a point, right? So if this witness actually has exculpatory evidence to bring forward, that witness actually has to be disclosed to the defense under a longtime Supreme Court case called Brady versus Maryland. So that's a situation where prosecutors required to disclose them. You make judgments about whether the state wants to use them, whether the defense wants to use them, limits to how much you can hide them. But even before you get to that, prosecutors have enormous discretion. Like, prosecutors start with the discretion whether to bring the charges in the first place, which charges to bring, what plea deal to offer, right? You change the complexion of a whole proceeding by charging more crimes, even more than you necessarily think you can prove, because you only have to just allege them, right? You have to get over a basic probable cause hurdle, but that's the old adage about, you know, a good prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich. And then, so now the person's facing decades in prison, and maybe the realistic exposure, you know, maybe this is really just a, you know, a misdemeanor assault case, but I can charge them with first degree assault, and they can face 25 years, and maybe they decide they need to take a plea to limit that to 5 instead of going to trial and getting whacked with the big charge. That discretion sits with the prosecutor in the first place. And that that all happens or not before you get anywhere near a courtroom, right? Judges can't make prosecutors exercise that discretion in any particular way or not. In fact, we had a case here recently. It's a really sad case of a woman who had previously been a victim of a violent sexual assault, ends up in a mental health crisis and runs out into the median strip near her home with a gun and a knife. And the police do a nice job of disarming her and sort of bring the whole situation to a close. And then they take her back to the police station holding cell before they take her to the hospital. And she's still kind of in crisis, and she's not super cooperative with them, but there's five of them and she's a small woman, and they end up sort of picking her up and carrying her to the, and there's video of all this. But the police then claimed that she'd assaulted them, and they charged her with, in the first trial, five counts of first degree assault and five counts of second degree assault. And she got sentenced the first time around to 15 years. We reversed it. They took her to trial again. She got five counts of second degree assault and got 25 years, all suspended. And we ended up having to affirm that. This is an example now of what I was talking about before. We ended up having to affirm the convictions and sentence because they were legal. But then we wrote a whole section of the opinion that says this case was grossly overcharged in the first place and they never should have brought it. Now, is that, you know, screaming into the void? Yeah, kinda, right? Because the prosecutors had the discretion to bring that case, and they did. And we affirmed the judgment. But we still had a perspective on how that discretion, that serious discretion, could or should have been employed in that case. And so that's, you know, that's a role we have, I think, when we have views on how power and authority and the law are being used, to explain them. That's even in a case that doesn't have a sort of controversy or a disagreement like that, that's one of the real benefits of the full written decision, is that we explain why we're deciding the case the way we are and why and how, and give, you know, people who read that, lawyers and parties and the public, an opportunity to see how the law is getting shaped and how it's going to get applied in the next case.
Is that message in part meant for the legislature? Are they the ones that can restrain in some ways that discretion?
In that particular case, not really, but in other cases, yes. I mean, because you'll run into situations where a statute as written requires you to reach a certain outcome that maybe doesn't seem optimal. And we often will say, look, we're stuck with this because of the way this law got written, but the General Assembly could change that if they wanted to. And there are other versions of that too, that sort of signal sending, right? You do that sometimes. We had a case, I was involved in a case a number of years ago. It was right after our General Assembly passed marriage equality here in Maryland. But there had been earlier case law from our high court saying that the non-biological same-sex partner had no so if you had a same-sex couple and one of them had a biological connection to a child, right, either gave birth to or contributed DNA to them, that the child had a parent relationship with that biological parent, but was literally a third party to the other unless they adopted them. And so that was a situation where right after people were allowed to get married in Maryland, same-sex couples were allowed to get married in Maryland, they then were also allowed to get divorced in Maryland. And this was the first same-sex divorce case. And it ran smack into some of these earlier decisions about same-sex couples and parenthood. And so we found ourselves as the lower court forced to reach a certain result. But then I wrote a concurrence saying, like, that earlier case makes no sense now that the legislature has approved same-sex marriage and y'all ought to fix it. And then they end up taking that case, and they actually fix it more broadly than even I thought they might in that opinion. So there's opportunities for us to send signals like that, whether it's to the legislature, to the high court, to to administrative agencies, to people who are making discretionary decisions. You know, now back in the case I mentioned a few minutes ago, I don't know if the elected state's attorney from that county will care that the three judges in Annapolis didn't like that decision. I don't know. But I hope that they will take that into account. And it's our opportunity to say what we think is important to say. And hopefully in our, you know, it'll function in our broader system, however it does.
Shifting gears a little bit, three episodes ago, we interviewed Aliza Schatzman, who founded the Legal Accountability Project. And you're currently on Legal Accountability Project's board of directors?
I am, since June of this year. Yep.
Fantastic. Why don't you say from your perspective what Legal Accountability Project does and what the point of it is?
Right. So Legal Accountability Project is as the title suggests, a nonprofit that seeks to promote transparency in the judiciary and accountability, specifically in the context of judicial clerkships. I've mentioned a couple of different times my law clerks, and we talked about Matt Dumont being in a clerkship now. Most judges, trial level, appellate level, we hire law clerks to assist us in what we do. I have three of them, and they overwhelmingly are people who are recent law school graduates. We hire them while they're still in law school, and then they come after law school and spend a year or two working with us, just like I did, you know, 30 some odd years ago after law school. The clerkship is, it functions sort of like the internships and residencies that doctors do. It's not required like it is for them, but it's a great opportunity to spend a year writing, thinking, growing, but mostly learning how and participating in the decisions that the judicial branch is making, so that when you go out to be a lawyer, you've been on the inside for a year, seeing how the decisions get made, seeing how the court works. And so the combination of that insight with literally the reps that you get as a writer and a decider it's a terrific growth opportunity. It builds professional networks. My clerks all look out for each other and have helped each other get jobs. And we have a reunion every year, and it's a good sort of initial professional network. And in a way, it's also sort of a personal and professional brand. Like I'm a Loken clerk. I was in the first class of Loken clerk because he'd just come on the court when I clerked for him. There's 101 of us as of last year. So that's kind of where clerkships sit in the profession. It's often a very well-regarded credential. It can be a really good stepping stone to other opportunities. And my clerkship was an overwhelmingly positive experience, but that is not always the case, right? You're working, clerks and judges work together in a very small, literally physically small space, but also a very small group environment. There's chambers is anywhere from 3 to 5 or 6 people at the most. And you're in a courthouse, and you're working with, in our case, you're working with other judges, but really almost all the time, it's the four of us here working together. Judges are human beings who have a wide degree of management skill. We were all lawyers for a long time. We have often type A personalities, and we come with our own biases and our own failures as human beings and managers. And so, you know, what Aliza had a terrible clerkship experience that she's testified about in Congress, and went beyond just like having a rough year. Her judge went out of his way to torpedo job opportunities for her in a really, you know, sort of awful, awful way. And while I don't agree that, you know, this is a universal experience, I think most clerkship experiences are positive. I think there are more negative clerkship experiences than people realize. And the project is really focused on creating more of available information so that students who are considering clerking and applying to individual judges know what that what they're getting into, know what the environment is like, know what the judge is like, know what the expectations are, know how as much as you can going into any job, sort of what the environment and what the experience are going to be like. So for me, you know, I came to know Aliza shortly after she testified in Congress. We had some back and forth because she sought sort of insight from me as a as someone who not only clerked myself, but also, you know, hires and mentors and works with law clerks constantly. You know, my thoughts on this transparency question and how to improve transparency. And I think alongside all of that, the growth in transparency will necessarily broadens and diversifies the clerk pool and the judiciary, right? Because I think most of us who become judges clerked as well. So there's, it's not a direct pipeline, but there's a lot of correlation there. And I think students, especially first gen students of color, students from other less represented backgrounds in our profession, I think they're likely to be more likely to clerk if they have a better sense of what they're getting into and what the person in the environment are going to be like. And I think there are a lot of judges who could benefit from having more information out there about the positive nature of the experience with them. So there's an opportunity to avoid bad experiences, but I think also an opportunity to create more positive information about good experiences. And so just sort of broadening the pool in general. What I found, I've been through 12 hiring cycles. And I've struggled over the years to have a hiring pool that was particularly diverse. And I've done a lot of things to try and I've had some success in more recent years. Some of that is being visible in law schools and getting more information out to students just about what this is and why they should think about it. But part of it, too, was delaying my clerkship hiring till after the end of the second year to give more students kind of four semesters worth of grades, four semesters worth of opportunities to do internships and build up their portfolios a little bit. And I found in the couple of years since I did that, my pool has gotten a lot more, it's gotten broader and more diverse. And I think LAP's database, when it goes live, only just enhances that demystification, that information gathering. I know one of Aliza's big points is it decouples some of that information flow from the schools, from the pipelines of professors and career services directors who in some instances are thought to guard that information carefully, who may be more concerned about protecting relationships with judges than in sharing everything they know. I don't know exactly, you know, school by school, how big a problem that is, but there's been some concern that that's been a problem in some places. And so this independent database and independent outreach, is meant to broaden the scope of that information that's available and hopefully allow more students to get into good clerkship experiences.
What makes a good clerk? What are you looking for when you look at applicants?
So I'm looking for critical and independent thinkers, right, who can express themselves clearly and who I want to spend a year with in a small space. And so those are kind of the three criteria. And they're all, I keep those criteria relatively vague on purpose because I think there are lots of different ways that people can satisfy them. I mean, I know there are some judges who have grade cutoffs, who will only hire students who are on law review, who are looking for specific tangible accomplishments and criteria. And those are often useful proxies. But I've hired I've hired students who were on law review and students who weren't. I've had students with a range of grades from the top of the class to very much the middle or even below that. I've had people who were on trial team and moot court. I've had presidents of the Black law students, Latinx law students, Asian law students, people who are in leadership roles at the law school, you know, in all kinds of different forms. And so I've purposely kept it vague because I want to hire individuals and not specific resume points. But I think that's also part of what we as judges need to do to help diversify the pool. I've also been involved in another organization called the Appellate Project. I don't know if you've heard of that, which is specifically designed to connect first-gen students and students of color with appellate opportunities. And one of the ways that the Appellate Project does that is they connect students and mentors. The mentors are sometimes judges, but they're often lawyers who practice in the appellate space. And so I've had mentors the last 2 years, or mentees. I've been a mentor to two students from Howard University. I'll get a new TAP student this school year as well. So I think all the different ways we can be visible, we can be accessible, we can get information out, are all going to incrementally sort of broaden the pool and broaden the opportunity.
So if I remember, it's critical thinking, express yourself well, primarily almost exclusively in writing, right?
And then, well, yeah, except when you hire them, I mean, you get writing samples, but then you're also talking with them, right? And yeah. So there's not a lot of oral presentation requirement, but we have to be able to talk about the case too. So it's not like they have to be smooth orators necessarily, but they have to be able to take the complicated problem mm-hmm. and express the problem and the solution as cleanly as possible. Yeah. So I'm sorry, I cut you off as you were walking through.
No. So critical thinking, good communication, which includes both oral and writing, yep. and then interpersonal skills in a sense that they can be someone that you can work with for the next year and have a right. positive experience.
And we have to do that in a team setting because there's four of us and two turn over every year, right? So I have three clerks. One is, I hesitate to say permanent because I've had four in 10 and a half years, but they're, I'd say durable, right? So, their title is senior law clerk. My senior law clerks have all been experienced lawyers who either have come back off maternity leave and are looking to get back into the workforce, or have just like recently moved to Maryland and need a platform to get into the market here. And they've stayed. I've colleagues whose senior law clerks have stayed with them longer. Sometimes you'll hear them referred to as career clerks or permanent clerks. So that person is around for usually 3 to 4 years. My current senior clerk is leaving me next summer to go do a federal clerkship. So I'll have to hire that one. But then the two term clerks, they come for a year, and so half my team turns over every year. And so I'm thinking about the personal side of it, both do I want to work with this person? Do I feel a personal connection with them? But also I prefer to hire them as a package. And one of the reasons I lost out on Matthew Mott was I like to do a bunch of interviews and then decide the team, as opposed to hiring one who comes early and then hiring one that comes later without the opportunity to sort of think of how they'll work together. And so while I was doing all my interviews, just as Houghton scooped Matt out from me, but I like to think about it as, you know, I'm trying to rebuild the team of four every year. And we all have to do some version of that. If you're a trial judge who has one law clerk and one judicial assistant, you know who 2/3 of it is, but that it's third to a half to even more. Supreme Court of the United States, they have four clerks and So it's whatever, 2/3 of the team is turning over every year. That's a lot. And you have to think about how those folks are going to work together and work well with all of us. And part of that too, my process is really iterative, and we are set up here so that all four of us touch literally every single opinion. Someone will be the primary drafter, but others are site checking and proofreading and weighing in on all of it. So we need everybody to be able not only to think critically, but to say, you know, if they're the one getting this a little bit later, seeing as they'll say, you know, to their co-clerk or to say to me, this doesn't make sense. I know you all have worked hard on this, but I don't get it. Or this raises this problem or whatever, and be able to feel sort of connected enough to that team and free to think critically and make the product better and not be intimidated. I tell a story of how so Judge Loken was incredibly smart. He clerked for Justice White on the Supreme Court. He was a big firm litigator in Minneapolis for 25 years, and he was a brand new judge when I got to him. And he was way smarter than I was then and ever will be. And, you know, so we're working through over the course of the year kind of how to do this together. And we would write the drafts and he would mark them up and he would say, does this make sense? And it usually did. But every now and then, you know, he would come to one of us and be like, I don't understand this, or why'd you do this way or whatever. And I think we all just kind of thought, well, he's the guy and he's a lot smarter and more experienced than we are. And so we would mostly just take what he said and I think figure out how to get there. But about 10 months in, we had a case where I had written this draft that it tracked the same way we'd handled a similar issue about a month before. So I thought, okay, this is easy. We've done this, and now I'll make it mirror that earlier one. And so he's looking at the second one, and he comes into me. He's like, this makes no sense to me. Like, why are you doing this way? I'm like, and I finally realized, like, oh, I need to push back here. Like, we did this a month ago, right? We're going to look like we missed something if we changed from our own case a month ago. It was the first time I really sort of pushed back on him, and he sort of went away and came back. And, you know, there were some differences between my draft and what he came up with eventually, but it was all sort of a lot closer. And I realized he, when he pushed back on us, he wanted us to push back on him too, all to sort of sharpen the outcome and get it right. And that's what I try to do here. You know, there aren't a lot of times where we disagree all that significantly about how a case should go, but there are a lot of cases where the process of getting from, this is a problem, to here's how we're going to solve this problem is really iterative. And we do have cases where the clerk writes it one way and I'm not quite there. But I try to, you know, we go back and forth, and maybe it ends up the way it started, and sometimes it flips. And so I'm looking for a team where we can fight our way through that and just get it right together. And the more perspectives you have, the better. You know, you can't get the huge range of perspectives with four people, but you can get different ones over the course of time, and we all can learn from each other and make it better.
So friendly, constructive disagreement.
Yeah, exactly. Because everybody's on the same mission, right? The mission is not to win inside the chambers. The mission is to get the case right, right? The mission is to try to get the law right. And I want people to tell me if they think that I'm getting this case wrong. I may disagree, right? Ultimately, it's my name on it. And so I guess I get the last word, but we'll get there together.
Producer Eric told us that you have currently a very personal connection to law school in your daughter.
I do. I have a daughter who's just started law school a couple weeks ago.
That is fantastic. How has that been as a father?
Oh, it's been very cool. I mean, we went through the whole application process together, and that was challenging and nonlinear and a little bit bumpy. But she's landed in a really great place. She's at the University of Michigan, and she's you know, walked in to a 300 person plus class of people who all want to be there and are all really smart, but none of whom know what the heck they're doing. Some will think they do. And there's already, it's been fun to hear some of the stories of the gunners, the people we all know from our law school experience. You know, and I don't get a ton of minute by minute detail, but, you know, she's in torts and contracts and constitutional law now. And I'll get it. I'll get a text or when we talk, she'll be excited about learning some concept and being able to see it again, sort of for what it is, right? You know, what is the point of contracts? Point of contracts is to understand if people have agreed on something. You can agree to almost anything, but what does it mean to have formed an agreement? Like when you start to think about, I mean, we've agreed on things in our lives from the very beginning. You agree with your kids that they're gonna put the switch down and go to bed in 5 minutes. But like, how do we know that agreement got formed? Well, you know, in the parental setting, you know, you have some force maybe to create adhesive agreements on bedtimes and things. But you know, offer, acceptance, consideration, like I can spit those things out. But when you learn that for the first time and you start to think about, you know, what it means to form an agreement in that kind of way, like it's cool to watch your child sort of see the world that way. So yeah, I mean, and we all have been there, right? It's an immersive experience. It's really heady. She has been she's had a couple of years of working and coaching lacrosse and traveling between the end of her undergrad and her master's degree and starting law school. So she's been ready to get back to school, and it's been fun to watch.
It's a beautiful place to do it. Did you go tour Michigan Law with her?
We did. And we had been up there. We had toured Michigan when she was looking at undergrad places. And although we went there in January at that point, and this time we went in May, and it was very, very different experience. Yeah, Ann Arbor is terrific. And the law school buildings are cool. They have a wonderful library reading room that while she was doing a lot of the touring, I hung out and just – I got some work done in this very, you know, Hogwartsian looking building.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, that law library is definitely, like you said, heady. It feels heady to be in that law library.
It does. And I used to study a lot in the law library in college, just because it was not only was it like a couple blocks away from where I lived. So like it was a little separation there, and there were usually there weren't any undergrads there. And so it was kind of a nice way to, and I don't know, there was always just cool kind of being around the books and all that. And yeah, the reading room and the main reading room in the law library at Michigan is beautiful. And they have a whole law quad there, which is nice.
Yeah.
You're part of a big Big Ten campus. She's been to a couple football games, sort of embracing the whole experience and already stressing out about her summer job for next year that, you know, she has to start looking for.
2 weeks in, she's already.
Yeah. Oh, they told them during orientation they had to get going on that.
Wow. Crazy. I'm going to start telling my LSAT students that I frequently get asked, you know, what's the type of student who's going to be successful as a law student? And well, did you go to the law library to do your studying when you were in undergrad? Might be one of my questions.
Yeah. I mean, maybe, you know, I don't know if I absorbed anything osmotically, but you soak up the environment a little bit.
Yeah. And it's just that you're the type of person who is very serious about your studies. I mean, you're going to, you're separating yourself from the undergrads because I got work to do.
Right. Ironically, when I was in law school at crunch time, I would go to the med school library to study because there were never any doctors in there. They were always in the hospital and there were no law students around. That was only during finals, right? During the rest of the year, you just kind of, you know, be in the law library. But when crunch time happened, it was, there was a small group of us who would decamp to the med school library for this for crunch time to get away from the other law students.
That's a good tip too. Yeah, separate yourself from the anxiety bubble.
Yeah, you got to find your people, right? That's another thing. She's already she's in a really good roommate situation and has, you know, and your small section is critical to that, right? Because those are the people, no matter what school you're in, like they all have some version of this where like you're in class, you're in every class with this relatively small group of people. And some of those, you know, become your best friends and the people you stay in touch with forever, which is true for me to this day. But you know, you have to kind of find your group of people, and you have to find the ways to sort of to study and soak up the material and talk through it that work best for you. There's no single formula, but it's, you have to keep up with it in a way you never did with undergrad. And, you know, maybe not everybody does well studying in a group setting, but I did. We would form these outline groups and talk through it together. And working with people was a great way to reinforce what you heard in class and hash through the stuff that you weren't getting. And so I think a big part of what you're doing is in the first year is you're finding your people, and reinforcing the learning that way is in addition to all the reading and studying you're doing yourself. And you never know where your classmates are going to end up, right? Your classmates may be your governor, or your judges, or your partners, or your colleagues, or your clients, right? Who knows? That's especially true here. You know, my law school classmates are pretty spread out, and I think people at T14 schools, you know, that's often the case. The students that I work with at University of Maryland and University of Baltimore, they're overwhelmingly all staying here in Maryland. And like those relationships, I mean, it's a small town anyway, right? Those relationships are important and durable, and you can go across the whole spectrum of law, government, politics, and your classmates are going to end up there. And so making personal, you don't have to be a glad hander or a social butterfly, but being a decent human being and sort of finding your people is important.
That makes me wonder, you know, what advice would you give to someone who was in the Maryland area, wanted to stay in the Maryland area, but they were weighing offers from law schools across the country? Is it worth going to, say, UC Berkeley instead of going to the University of Maryland if they have goals in, you know, if they wanted to come clerk for you, for example?
Well, so I think the answer is it depends, right? And it depends a lot on what your goals are. I mean, I think everybody should go to the law school that's the right fit for them. And there are advantages and certain access to certain opportunities that the T14 schools will give you that the lower tier schools might not, right? If you want to do a federal clerkship, if you want to go into certain kind of Justice Department gigs or competitive nonprofit spaces or big city, big law firms, like you're going to have a cleaner path to that from a top 14 school than you are from schools that, I don't know, the rankings create this illusion of precision. But even if you sort of tier them, you see that. I mean, students from schools like University of Maryland, University of Baltimore do phenomenally well and can do all of those things that I just described, right? I have my own clerks who are Maryland grads who have gone from here to do federal clerkships and who are working in DC big law firms and all that stuff. Like there's no shortage of opportunity, but it's harder. It's a harder path. You may have to stack a state court clerkship right before you do your federal one. You may have to do a lot better in the class at a lower ranked school to achieve certain things. So it depends a little bit on how important certain goals are to you. But, you know, from a I mean, there are amazing lawyers from a whole range of schools that I've come across over the years, and also people from incredibly fancy schools who were underwhelming. I mean, it's the school itself is just, it's a place, and it's what you make of it as a person and as a student and as a future lawyer. I mean, another huge, and I, you kind of hinted at this with your question, you know, another layer to that same question is, do I want to strap on the debt to go to one school versus another, whether it's because it's my in-state school where I can, where the tuition's a lot lower, although some states that get delta is not so big. At Michigan, you save something like $3,000 a year being in-state. Whereas in Maryland, it's big. I think it's, you know, the in-state full boat tuition at Maryland is half of what a private is, right? So, or the other layer, and I know this is part of what you guys do, you know, getting the LSAT score up creates scholarship opportunities, creates full ride opportunities. And so you find yourself deciding whether you're going to go to one school versus another, in part because of prestige, in part because of fit, but also in part of money, right? If you have to borrow 3 years of tuition, you owe a house when you get out, not a car like I did. And so those are all important considerations, and there's no right or wrong answer. I mean, my daughter did turn down a full ride at another school to go to Michigan with a nice scholarship, but not, not full, right? So, but she felt at home there, and especially like connected with faculty there even before, while she was on the wait list and trying to get in, and wanted to go. I think part of it is having your dad as a judge with a discernible last name, you know, made her want to go somewhere else for her own adventure. And I totally get that. But there are important trade-offs in all of that, right? I mean, if you have an opportunity to go to a very good law school for a lot less money, the analysis of whether you're better off taking that debt is not obvious, right? And what you want is the opportunity to make your own decision.
Yeah. Which you can get by applying to more than one school at least, right? Multiple schools.
Yes.
And which sounds like your daughter did. So that's...
She did. She applied to a lot of schools.
Yeah. You know, Judge, I want to ask you about this. We say T14 on the podcast all the time, but and you've mentioned it a few times here. At the same time, that it's not some hard and fast line, right?
It's not,
it's not like you get to 15 and, oh, okay, well, now, well, see you later. We don't care about that. So
no,
from your perspective,
it's a shorthand. It's a very loose, like you could say top tier. I don't like, you know, whatever. It's... You know.
Do you have a number where you're like, okay, that's getting too low for
No, because my applicants come overwhelmingly from two schools, neither of which are in the T14 by any ranking measure, right? Maryland is in the sort of mid-40s. Baltimore is like 120th. I had a broader range of applicants this year. I had one from Duke. I had one from Wash U in St. Louis. I had some from GW and George Mason and a few of the other, and American. So I had more schools in my applicant pool this year than I ever had. But look, state court intermediate appellate judges are not generally where the top tier, top 20 school students are looking. They're overwhelmingly looking for federal judges, who get hundreds of applications from all over the country. I get a couple dozen applications, mostly from the schools that are here in our state. Our state Supreme Court judges get a little more than that, but nothing like the feds do. So no, I don't have any arbitrary cutoffs. I'd be pleased to have students from everywhere. I mean, there are whatever you want to say about the reliability or precision of the rankings, there definitely are differences school to school in the sort of the rigor of the students they're taking. And there's differences in how deep in the class you can go at one school versus another. But like I said, I don't have super rigid criteria on that. And I think, you know, there are, I've known students who struggled with test taking in their first year and end up with grade point averages that don't look so great, but you see improvement and trajectory and you see that they can write papers and you talk to the professors and find out that they get it in class, that what are the artificial test taking exercise doesn't translate as well. And so you still have to get to know people. And you know, the students at the top, just to use the two local schools as an example, the students at the top of the class at the University of Baltimore, which is a whatever 120-ish ranked school by U.S. News, are as good as anybody. And the top kids at the University of Maryland, they'd be at home and do well if you put them anywhere. You know, you can then argue about like, well, if you pick from the lower ranks of the class at one school versus another, how's that going to turn out? I mean, and there's some range there, but like I said, great lawyers come from all kinds of places, and crappy lawyers come from all kinds of places, and you ultimately have to meet and work with, and in my case, hire people, not profiles.
Judge, you've been very generous with your time. Ben, do you have any final questions?
No. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. This is I hope your LSAT preppers are interested. Most of what we talked about is sort of down the road for them, but maybe hopefully gives them some again in the sort of LAP vein, gives them some sense of what they're getting into.
It'll be there before they know it. The time does fly, and maybe you'll get some a broader set of clerk applicants because of this.
I hope so. I'll watch for the cover letter that says I heard you on the podcast. So, I'll look for that.
Cool. Thanks so much for coming on. Judge Douglas Nazarian has served on the Appellate Court of Maryland since January 2013. We really appreciate you coming on the Thinking LSAT podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys. Take care.
I want to say thanks one more time to Judge Nazarian for coming on the show. Really appreciate your time. Listeners, you can be LSAT famous. Ask us questions or share news with us at thinkinglsat.com. If you have questions about the LSAT demon, you should email the best customer service team in the world. That is help@lsatdemon.com. Please check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 421 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.